Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
Hello, I'm Katia Adler. Today on The Global Story, I'll be taking a look at the other war going on in Ukraine, the war against corruption. International support hangs in the balance. The Global Story brings you fresh takes and smart perspectives from BBC journalists around the world. Find us wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Alex Ritson, and at 14 hours GMT on Tuesday, the 5th of December, these are our main stories. Israeli forces appear to be mounting a major military operation in southern Gaza, where conditions for civilians are reportedly ever more perilous. The Nigerian president has called for a full investigation into military drone strikes that have killed dozens of villagers. And the British government is taking further steps at home and abroad to tighten its immigration policies. Also in this podcast, thousands of people have taken to the streets of New Zealand to join demonstrations against the new coalition government. And
Lucia, do you know why you're here?
Bad luck, I guess.
We look at the latest trailer for Grand Theft Auto, which has been released early after it was leaked online. The World Health Organization says the situation in Gaza is getting worse by the hour, with intensified bombing by Israeli forces around the southern towns of Khan Yunis and Rafah. An Israeli spokesman said the government expected difficult combat in this latest phase of its offensive. Israeli ground troops are stepping up their operation in Khan Yunis with what the Israeli Defense Force described as close-quarter fighting and aerial bombardment. Lieutenant Colonel Richard Hecht is an IDF spokesman.
Since the hostilities have returned, we're expanding our operations against Hamas across all of Gaza. We're targeting operatives, infrastructure, and mainly the tunnel network. So far, we have located over 800 tunnel shafts and destroyed 500 of these. The level of fortification is unprecedented. While we've been operating, we are ensuring that there is minimum harm to civilians, with soldiers on the ground going from building to building.
Many international organisations have expressed concern about the deteriorating situation inside Gaza. And a spokesperson for the Gazan Health Ministry, which is controlled by Hamas, said the situation in hospitals there was catastrophic.
The wounded and patients are on the floor. There's no life-saving health service in the hospitals of the southern Gaza Strip. Hence, hospitals in the southern Gaza Strip have totally collapsed. They cannot deal with the injuries that arrive. It's difficult for ambulances to reach the injured in the targeted areas. The Israeli occupation targets ambulances that move in the southern areas of the Gaza Strip.
The violence has also displaced many Palestinians multiple times, including Ghada al-Kurd, who has lost loved ones to Israeli airstrikes and is now cut off from most of her family. She spoke to Michelle Hussein from Khan Yunis about what life is like there.
Food, we have to go far away to the market to bring some food. Maybe 2 kilometers or 3 kilometers, it's considered like far, and airstrikes, like it's in everywhere. So we are taking the risk to go to bring some only vegetables. There's no fruit and meat. It's very rare. We cannot like bring meat, and it's very expensive. It's like triple nowadays, the prices. Inside the shelter, there is some people are coming to sell some food, but it's not enough.
And what about money? Do your family have cash, or do you still have access to banks?
Well, it's very difficult. We were like, there was some cash with us for the first month, the second month, but nowadays it's almost like finished. So even the bank accounts, like we cannot go to the banks, even it's closed. Even Western Union also, we have to wait like for a couple of hours to get some money.
What are you prepared for? Do you think you might end up having to move again?
We're discussing this in the morning, me and my sister. And I said for her, like, where to go? This is the fifth place that we are evacuating to. Like, we were in Gaza City, then we moved to a Shifa hospital at the first week. Then we moved to Nasser in Gaza City, and we moved to middle area. They are going to say, like, carry all of your stuff. You know, this is the winter season.
Our Middle East correspondent Yoland Nell gave me the latest on Israel's military campaign.
We've seen that Israel has intensified its bombing in and around Gaza's second largest city, Khan Yunus, which is in the south, as its ground forces are also advancing there. Locals say that they have seen Israeli tanks and armoured vehicles to the east of the city and also to the north as well. Now, a lot of people at the Nasser Hospital, one of the main hospitals in Khan Yunus, people were being rushed in there this morning, dozens of wounded people, after an area in the east was hit by Israeli shelling, local people said, and also by strikes. This was an area close to a UN school that's been used as a shelter for displaced people, and Palestinians said that there were about 30 people who were killed. Besides those kind of chaotic scenes, we've also had a lot of people on the road once again, many of them people who've been displaced that are heading further to the south, heeding these Israeli evacuation orders that affect tens of thousands of people living in about 20 neighbourhoods to the east of Khan Yunus.
And the Israeli military extremely worried about any female captured soldiers which are taken by Hamas.
Indeed, there have been these fears about sexual violence from the 7th of October, back when we've had many people who are either victims or witnesses to sexual assaults carried out, they say, by Hamas fighters and others involved in those attacks. So that is said to have been used as a kind of weapon of war, really, by Hamas. And now there is a lot of concern. The US State Department has been voicing concern about the women who are still being held. Many of them are soldiers. Certainly, we know as well that there is this division between categories of people by Hamas. While it's allowed out women and children in the first stages of the hostage exchange, we're told also that Hamas views any women who are serving in the Israeli military different from the other women that were affected there.
And there's also been talk about Israel flooding Gaza's tunnels.
Yes, this is a report in the Wall Street Journal. Israel has set up large pumps on the coast that could be used to flood tunnels used by Hamas and other armed groups, this big network under the Gaza Strip, the newspaper says. The Israeli military has said since it can't comment on the report, but it's saying that it's doing everything it can to make the tunnel system in Gaza unusable.
Yoland Nell in Jerusalem. Meanwhile, in Israel, how much are people concerned with the widening of the military campaign in Gaza? Hemi Shalev is an Israeli commentator. He spoke to Rob Young.
There have been no polls about the specific widening of the conflict, but generally speaking, there's been massive support for the government's aim of eradicating Hamas or destroying Hamas or neutralizing it. And there's been very little opposition heard either in the polls or in the public arena.
What about the resumption of fighting, though, given that there are still some 130 Israeli hostages thought to be held in the Gaza Strip?
That is the complicating factor. There's a lot of support for the families of the kidnapped, and there are people who believe that the cancellation of the agreement and the resumption of hostilities, and naturally they fear that it endangers the hostages. But nonetheless, and even though there is a lot of sympathy for their position and they think that negotiations should have continued, nonetheless, I don't see any real opposition to the widening of the war. At this point, for the next few days at least, I don't think such opposition is likely to appear anywhere.
And we're hearing that almost 16,000 people have been killed in the Gaza Strip since Israeli military action began. People who had fled from the north of that territory to the south are now being told they must move further south as Israel's bombing campaign widens. What is the view of Israelis of the tactics which are being used, of the humanitarian disaster which appears to be unfolding in the Gaza Strip?
Well, I think objectively speaking, Israelis have not been subjected to the kind of television pictures and reports from Gaza that you and everyone else in the world is seeing. The Israeli media has reported on the destruction in Gaza, but perfunctorily, not at length. And so there is no reaction to the civilian toll. But I have to point out one thing, you know, even though for you and the rest of the world, October 7th was almost 2 months ago, for Israelis, it's still going on. The 90, 80%, 70% of the reports on TV don't have to do with the military campaign that's going on now or with any other matter, but rather with the events of October 7th, which were so widespread, horrific, and multiple that almost 8 weeks later, they're still bare telling. So I think psychologically, Israelis have yet to move on from the shock, the anger, and the rage of October 7th, which means that they are less inclined to view or to take an interest even in the how much damage is being caused in Gaza.
Hemi Shalev speaking to Rob Young, and we'll hear more about the conflict later with a special report from the occupied West Bank. More than 80 people have died in Nigeria after army drones struck a village in Kaduna State. The drones were meant to be targeting militants, but attacked the village during a Muslim festival. I asked our correspondent in Lagos, Azizat Olaoluwa, how the strike happened.
Some Muslim faithful were said to be celebrating the birth of the Prophet Muhammad. And then before they knew what could happen, the military drone strike hit, killing a number of people. And then about 30 minutes into that, the people that survived said they tried to, you know, recover the bodies that they saw. Some mangled bodies were hanging from rooftops, from trees. So they rushed in to pack the bodies up, and then another drone strike hit, killing more people. And that is why the casualty team, according to Rights Group, would be higher than 85. There are no official figures yet.
But how can that be an accident?
So, well, that's the question, but it's not the first time this would happen. Between 2017 to 2023, about 425 civilians have died, women and children inclusive, in accidental air raids like this. And this happens because, you know, the northwestern Nigeria and northeastern Nigeria are affected by terrorism, banditry and other criminal actions like kidnapping for ransom. So many of these bandits and terrorists are known to, you know, operate deep inside the forest where they, you know, when they kidnap their victims, they go there and hide them there. So it makes it more difficult for authorities or security operatives to rescue such victims. So the Nigerian military, most of the time, usually resort to air raids, you know, to rout out this militant. And that's why this happens often. But unfortunately for them, there are civilian casualties involved most of the time. So this is not the first time.
Azizat Olaoluwa in Lagos. The British Home Secretary James Cleverly has been in the Rwandan capital, Kigali, to sign a new agreement to deport asylum seekers to the Central African country. It's the third time a British Home Secretary has visited in the past 2 years, and yet no one has been deported to Rwanda. The new agreement is a response to the UK Supreme Court ruling last month that the government's plans were illegal. Maini Jones is in Kigali.
It's an ordinary weekday here in Kigali, the capital of Rwanda. Lots of people going about their work. As we arrived earlier, we saw dozens of foreign visitors coming to the country for the many conferences that it hosts. And that is the image that the Rwandan government wants to send out to the world, that of a modern, vibrant African nation, one of the continent's fastest growing economies. But the country's critics say that human rights here are not being respected, that freedom of expression is often curbs and that arbitrary detentions are commonplace. There's also been criticism from the opposition that says that the country cannot afford to take in asylum seekers from the UK, that it's still a developing nation that should be focusing on its own. Anecdotally, we're told that the reaction among many Rwandans is mixed. Some of them are indifferent to this treaty with the UK government. Others are in favour of it, thinking that the country should open its arms to foreign visitors. And then there are those who believe that Rwanda is already too full and should focus on its own people before opening its doors out to others.
Maini Jones. China may well find it both more expensive and more difficult to borrow money after the Western credit agency Moody's gave it a negative outlook, meaning it believes its creditworthiness is getting worse. The reason is the boom and bust in its property sector, where tumbling prices mean developers are at risk of going bankrupt without finishing projects. Nick Marsh has spent the night on a 100 $1 billion Chinese project in Malaysia, which was supposed by now to be home to 1 million people. 8 years after it started, it's still only 1% occupied.
I'm on the tip of Malaysia, driving south towards the coast, and there's something strange in the distance. A dozen tower blocks on the horizon. Locals call it Ghost City. And on first impressions, it's hard to believe that anyone actually lives here. Okay, this is Forest City. It's a bit dark. I think someone's forgotten to turn the lights on. Oh, here they are. Even in mid-afternoon, the long corridors in the towers are pitch dark. It feels more like a haunted house than a happy home. It's a reminder that you don't have to be in China to feel the effects of its property crisis.
No, it's not going to be long-term, definitely.
Finding residents was a struggle, but eventually I met Joanne Kaur. She moved here from northern Malaysia and has been renting for the past 4 months.
Do you feel like it's a ghost town?
From what I've seen so far, yes. I would have to agree.
Yeah. Maybe you should try after 12. Take a stroll.
Country Garden Group built a prime model of future city.
Forest City was a chance for people in China's aspirational middle class to invest in a second home abroad, which they could then rent out to locals here. But the company behind the project, Country Garden, is facing debts of nearly $200 billion.
Forest City, a dream paradise for all mankind.
It's one of many Chinese developers in deep trouble. A couple of years ago, the government in China became alarmed at the sheer amount of money that property companies were borrowing, so it imposed strict rules to limit speculation. Now, with cash drying up, Forest City is a surreal place. It's like visiting an abandoned holiday resort. So I'm in the shopping mall now. Half of it's still basically just a building site. But in front of me, there's a kid's train, no one on it, and the driver is just doing endless loops around the mall.
It's lonely around here. You're on your own.
This is Nazmi Hanafia. He used to live in Forest City, but after 6 months, he decided to cut his losses and get out. He didn't even mind losing his rental deposit.
It's a multi-billion project. It's supposed to be good. It's supposed to meet expectation, but it's frustrating.
It's frustrating for Nazmi, but it's alarming if you've actually bought a place here. Buyers in China were reluctant to talk to the BBC, even anonymously, but you can find comments on Chinese social media asking how to get a refund from the ghost city. One said, "The price has dropped so much, I'm speechless." There's a storm brewing in China's property sector right now, and it's causing a headache for the Chinese government. Many millions in China have invested their life savings into projects just like this, and they'll be wanting some reassurance sooner rather than later. This time,
this time behind the doors. Nick Marsh. Still to come on the Global News podcast, a Tesla whistleblower says the company's assisted driving technology isn't safe enough to be used on the road.
Even if you don't have a Tesla, your children still walk on the footpath. I had this terrifying feeling that one day a car might just harm them.
The Global News podcast brings you the world's latest breaking news and developments. But some stories need a little more time. I'm Katia Adler, host of the brand new BBC World Service podcast, The Global Story. Every weekday, The Global Story peels back the layers on one major news story with insights from the BBC's worldwide network of experts. So find out all the latest news right here on The Global News podcast and then dive into one big story with me on The Global Story. Search for The Global Story wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
Hello, I'm Katya Adler. Today on The Global Story, I'll be taking a look at the other war going on in Ukraine, the war against corruption. International support hangs in the balance. The Global Story brings you fresh takes and smart perspectives from BBC journalists around the world. Find us wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
Thousands of people have taken to the streets of New Zealand to join peaceful protests and demonstrations against the new coalition government on the opening day of Parliament. Maori leaders say the new government wants to limit Maori rights. Elsewhere in Parliament, some Maori MPs deviated from the traditional oath of allegiance to King Charles, sparking a debate on whether the wording was offensive. I asked the BBC's Phil Mercer what sparked the protests.
Well, these protests, Alex, attracted thousands of people. There was a noisy rally outside a building called the Beehive, which is the New Zealand Parliament in the capital, Wellington. There, protesters say that the new Conservative coalition government has a racist agenda against Indigenous rights, with plans to wind back policies that acknowledge Maori as New Zealand's first inhabitants, and also to limit the use of Maori languages, and also to scrap a dedicated Indigenous health authority. So all of this has led to a big division between Maori people and the incoming Conservative coalition government. And we've seen some pretty noisy demonstrations, and these protesters say that this is just the start, that there could well be more protests pretty soon, and certainly there will be more, they say, in the coming weeks and months.
Phil Mercer. The protests are an early leadership test for the Prime Minister, Christopher Luxon, who said the government would work for all New Zealanders. The co-leader of the political party Te Pāti Māori, which organised the protests, is Debbie Naroa-Paka. She spoke to my colleague Rob Young.
What was really exciting about today is that we had just as many non-Māori as we had Māori supporting the pushback that we don't want to go backwards. We don't want to go back to 60 years where it's okay to smoke so that we have tax cuts for the rich. We don't want to go back to a stage where our Indigenous language is relegated or hidden and not allowed to be used. We don't want to go back to a period where, you know, incarceration is the best way to deal with justice and prison our way through to justice. We actually want to grow and be a prospering, you know, partnering.
Do you have some ideological beef with the government as well as some of the specific Maori issues that we've been talking about? Do you regard this government as anti-Maori?
Yes. And it's not my personal view. It's backed by stats. It's backed by the anti-smoking. They want to undo a Māori health authority, which addresses Māori health inequities. And yet they want to increase smoking, which kills Māori three times more than anyone else. So, yes, their platform is very much an anti-Māori policy platform.
But you accept that you just can't change what the coalition government agreed just weeks ago?
I don't. I think if we accept that, then we're accepting racism, we're accepting discrimination of Indigenous peoples. And that is something that I don't think we should ever normalise and accept. That may be their promises that they have to keep in a political sense, but I don't think any Indigenous peoples across the world would accept that rhetoric.
Debbie Naroa-Paka from the Te Pāti Māori political party in New Zealand. A former Tesla technician has claimed that the company's assisted driving technology isn't safe enough to be used on the road. The electric car maker says autopilot enhances safety and comfort behind the wheel. But Lucas Krupski, who's in the UK receiving a whistleblowing award, has leaked data to US regulators and the German press, raising safety concerns.
I don't think the hardware is ready and the software is ready. It's essentially experiments on public roads. So even if you don't have a Tesla, your children still walk on the footpath. I had this terrifying feeling that one day a car might just harm them.
Tesla hasn't commented on the claims. Our technology editor, Zoe Kleinman, has been looking at what's being asserted.
Lukas Krupski worked for Tesla in Norway, and he has an interesting story. He was a hero at first. He put out a fire in a delivery center, and he got an email from Elon Musk thanking him personally. And the two exchanged some correspondence in which he highlighted what he claimed were some safety concerns. And at that point, he says his managers turned against him, and he had a very, very difficult time at work. And then he found that he could access a lot of company information, very personal data, including details of employers, but also lots of correspondence about safety concerns, he says, about the cars. And some of the things he claims he saw really alarmed him. So, for example, and we have heard about it, there's an issue with automated cars, phantom braking is what they call it. So it's when they brake when they shouldn't. The sensors pick something up that isn't there, or they misinterpret it and they slam the brakes on. He said there was a lot of correspondence about that, a lot more than he expected to see. And he also says he believes that the technology that's been built isn't really ready and shouldn't be deployed on the roads. Now, what he did with that data is controversial, because he handed it over to the US regulators and also to the German newspaper. And the Dutch data authority is currently investigating whether that was a data breach. But he says he did it because he felt so strongly that people needed to know what was going on and that he wasn't getting anywhere internally with Tesla.
And what did Tesla say?
Well, Tesla did not respond to any of our emails, but they do release some safety information. The last lot of figures they released was at the end of 2022, and they said that on average, people driving Teslas and using this autopilot assisted drive feature are having a crash where the airbag is deployed roughly once every 5 million miles driven. And Tesla drivers not using autopilot are having a crash with the airbag roughly once every 1.5 million miles. And that compares, Tesla says, with the national average of all drivers having that kind of accident once every 600,000 miles. But Justin, it's worth pointing out that we can't independently verify those figures because they've come directly from Tesla itself.
Zoe Kleinman. As the war in Gaza continues, there's also been a rise in violence in the West Bank, the other Palestinian territory occupied by Israel. Allies of Israel have condemned a sharp rise in attacks on Palestinian civilians by armed Israelis who've settled there. These settlements are seen by most countries as a violation of international law. According to a Palestinian government tally, more than 250 Palestinians have been killed by Israeli soldiers and settlers in the West Bank since Hamas's attack on October the 7th. Religious Jews believe the land was given to them by God, and the leaders of the settlers say they're protecting themselves. From the West Bank, Jeremy Bowen sent this report.
Where the Judean desert tumbles down to the River Jordan lies a tiny community of Palestinian Bedouins. It's called Arab Il Mlihat, and it looks timeless. The village, really just a family compound, lies a few minutes from an illegal outpost of Jewish settlers who came calling a few nights ago. Muntazar, 23-year-old son of one of eight brothers here, videoed what happened. The settlers accused them, falsely the family said, of stealing their goats. One, wearing a police jacket, loaded his assault rifle. They thought they were about to die.
He was shooting at my uncle, so I ran down there and confronted him. We were pushing each other and screaming, head to head. Then, around 20 settlers came.
Now they said they had to trust God as Israel's police and army protect the settlers. Before Gaza, two or three settlers with pistols might steal sheep. Now it was more than 20 with assault rifles. The settlers want to force them out, and this family believes the Israeli government has given them the weapons to do it. In 3 days of traveling through the occupied West Bank, Palestinians have said consistently that since the war in Gaza, Jewish settlers are better armed and much more aggressive. At Susia, south of Hebron, soldiers checked us out. They filmed us, but took much less interest in what had happened a few miles down the road. The village of Kirbit Zanuta had been bulldozed, activists said last night. Zanuta's 200 Palestinians left 4 weeks ago after a barrage of threats from armed Jewish settlers. Someone drew Jewish Stars of David. A settler leader cancelled an interview. The police said they were waiting for a complaint. In fact, Zanuta's Palestinians have petitioned Israel's Supreme Court. We went to the village with a former Israeli Special Forces soldier who now campaigns against the occupation.
They are demolishing Palestinian villages, beating up Palestinian farmers, stealing their olives. They are trying to open a third front, an east front, against the Palestinians. Why? The Palestinian West Bank. Why? Because they want the land without Palestinians.
Palestinians see all this and the rest of the settler violence on the West Bank as confirmation of their worst fears, that there are powerful elements inside Israel, in the government as well as the settler movement, who want them out and who are using the enormous crisis surrounding the Gaza war as an opportunity to further their agenda.
Jeremy Bowen in the West Bank. And now,
Lucia, do you know why you're here?
Bad luck, I guess.
Part of the trailer for the sixth installment of Grand Theft Auto, which has been released early after it leaked online. The game, which is due in 2025, will feature the first female lead character, Lucia, in the series. Our Asia business reporter Monica Miller has been taking a look.
This leak came 15 hours early than expected, but nevertheless, they decided to go for it. I'm just looking on YouTube, and it already has 6.3 million views. And again, we're just talking about the trailer. We're not talking about the game, which you're going to have to wait until 2025. It is just staggering how successful this is. This will be the sequel to the smash hit GTA 5, which was released in 2013, which became the second best-selling video game of all time behind Minecraft. I mean, we're looking at numbers around 190 million copies worldwide. And the trailer confirms many of these details that people had been already expecting. We are seeing that the female protagonist, she goes on a crime spree through crowded beaches, city highways, and clubs with her partner in a Bonnie and Clyde scenario. I mean, several analysts are saying that this is a sure instant win. It's going to make billions of dollars in sales. And Rockstar has also separately made an announcement that with Netflix, it will bring several of its titles as part of its gaming offering. That includes GTA 3, Vice City, and San Andreas will be made available to Netflix subscribers on mobile devices starting on the 14th of December.
Monica Miller. And that's all from us for now, but there'll be a new edition of the Global News podcast later. If you want to comment on this podcast or the topics covered in it, you can send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. You can also find us on X, formerly known as Twitter, at Global News Pod. This edition was produced by Alice Adderley and mixed by Chris Hansen. The editor is Karen Martin. I'm Alex Ritson. Until next time, goodbye.
Hello, I'm Katia Adler. Today on The Global Story, I'll be taking a look at the other war going on in Ukraine, the war against corruption. International support hangs in the balance. The Global Story brings you fresh takes and smart perspectives from BBC journalists around the world. Find us wherever you get your BBC podcasts.